Welcome to the Cover Brothers, where we're covering covers and looking for cover lovers. Come on in. The times are tough, man. Just getting tougher. This whole world is rough. It's just getting rougher. Cover me. Come on, baby, cover me. Well, I'm looking for a lover who won't come on in and cover me.
I got a song to sing to keep me out of the cold, and I'll meet you further on up the road. Welcome to another episode of the Cover Brothers. I'm Micha Levy, and with me virtually are my two brothers, my older brother and co-host Judah.
Hey now.
And my younger brother, calling in all the way from Israel, Dov.
How's it going, everybody?
So it's been a while since we've done a podcast. It's been a long while since we've done it, just the three of us.
This was the original. This was the first one.
It was
the OG.
What was the date of the, when do you know when we did our first podcast?
I don't. It was deep into the
sometime July.
It was the first COVID scare. Now we're dealing with the second COVID scare. So today we're going to be talking about a really interesting set of covers. It's the first time we've done this type of episode where we're actually going to be looking at covers from the same musician but with a different band. And so we'll get to that in a bit, but today we're going to be talking about the song Further On Up the Road. Now, I want to make this very clear. We are talking about the Bruce Springsteen song Further On Up the Road, not the Bobby Bland Band Farther On Up the Road, the Eric Clapton Farther On Up the Road, all those other Farther On Up the Roads that you may have heard. That's F.A.
I made that mistake looking up the songs today.
Right, exactly. And Dub will be poorly prepared for this one because he did the wrong song, but we're going to keep pushing on ahead anyway because we're going to get further on up the road.
I've corrected that mistake.
And he corrected that mistake.
Anyway, very hard to get any information on Further On Up the Road by Bruce Springsteen because whenever you type that in, you will almost inevitably get the Eric Clapton performance at the last waltz of Further On Up the Road or Farther On Up the Road. There's a discrepancy as to which is the right way to say it. And, you know, it's caused a lot of issues for us, both in doing the research for this episode as well as just in our lives trying to discuss this song and not being sure about whether it's actually a cover of the Bobby Bland Band version. I think we've had this conversation where we're like, oh no, Bruce covered or he rearranged the Further On Up the Road from the original like blues version.
Yeah.
And then we're like, wait, no, he didn't. Like, it's a totally different song.
It is funny because like, I mean, I don't know if you want to do like a brief history of it, but we've talked to numerous people about the song and like no one seems to have a fucking clue like whose song this really is. There have been times where we're discussing the song and we could talk for 5 or 6 minutes and then we realize we're all discussing different versions of the song and nobody knows what each other's talking about. So it's very complicated.
It is complicated. And the other thing is that I think for years of my life, I thought that Bruce Springsteen was covering Johnny Cash and not the other way around. So we'll get into all of that when we get into the nitty gritty of the episode. So why don't we start off? So we're talking about Further On Up the Road. The first version is the original by Bruce Springsteen. It comes out on The Rising in 2002. Though from my little bit of research, it seems like he was playing it in 99 when he was doing some of the rehearsals for the reunion tour. They were rehearsing it down in Asbury, but we get it. The studio version put out in 2002. The Rising wins Best Rock Album in 2003. And yet this song, I think, is a fairly underappreciated song on the album and in Bruce's discography in general. One thing I found interesting about this song, which is not really into the music of it just yet, but Bruce actually ended up taking lines from this song and incorporating them into two other songs that he released on his album, Devils in Dust. So there are lines from this song that make their way into Maria's Bed and All I'm Thinking About, which the album comes out in 2005, but we're pretty sure that those songs were probably made earlier. So it goes into this kind of interesting question about how Bruce and how a lot of writers write, which is this idea of like recycling lyrics.
We're kind of seeing this as his career kind of comes to an end a little bit, especially in his most recent album that came out a few weeks ago. He really has such a kind of a vast group of songs and lyrics and music kind of in his portfolio that either hasn't been released or maybe was only played live. And now as he's kind of nearing that end, he's starting to rearrange things, put things out that you would think, oh, he just must have made this kind of in the last few years. And you realize, wait, he's had this in his repertoire since 1973. So I think, you know, we're seeing with him that this kind of happens a lot.
Yeah, I think another like interesting point I always think about to Micha's comment about the writing, this is actually like, this is something that Bruce does kind of a lot. If you listen to hit a couple songs of his, especially I find it's stuff that's on like albums like Tracks or some slightly like lesser known Bruce stuff, sometimes stuff that never got recorded that ends up being recorded like on The Promise, which is songs from when he was writing Darkness on the Edge of Town, and he had, you know, 40 songs and he whittled it down to 10. And so he put a bunch of others out on an album, you know, in like 2011, I think it was. Like one of my favorites is there's a song called Santa Ana, which Bruce wrote in like the very early 70s and never got recorded, comes out on Tracks, that album. And there's a really, really great line in it. I think he uses the terms French cream won't soften them boots and French kisses. But I don't know if it's that entire line. The point is he then used that in Santa Ana, and then that becomes like a lyric in She's the One. And I only realized that like after listening to both of them kind of together and listening for us, I was like, oh shit, like he does this where he'll use lines in different songs and record both of them. And it's great. So
let's talk about the song. My opinion is, even though it's somewhat underappreciated in this album, it fits the album's theme, I think, so well.
Perfectly.
And I really think that the contrast between this song and Waiting on a Sunny Day, I really feel like they are thematically connected in a way. You know, you have the line, one sunny morning will rise, I know, and I'll meet you further on up the road, contrasting with, you know, waiting on a sunny day, trying to take the clouds away. Like, I really find that, and if you listen to musically, they both start off with like a similar drum groove. Those two themed songs really work well together. And I just think that this song, in terms of the album, I mean, it has all the themes of the album, you know, striving in the face of adversity, getting over whatever is in your way, and being hopeful that there will come a new day that you will meet your long lost friend. So I love the theme of this song. Dee, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely fits it's that kind of ironic theme of The Rising, which is released, you know, a year or two after 9/11, and really screams kind of, oh, this was written, you know, after 9/11 as kind of a message to the country, only to figure out that half the songs, or I don't remember exactly, I mean, all the songs, most of them, were already written, and it just kind of by happenstance fit what was going on in the world at that time. And if anything, I would say, you know, I agree with you that it goes with Waiting on a Sunny Day. You know, if I was Bruce, I would have wanted to end, if the whole album is about, you know, going through suffering and difficulty and kind of coming out with a positive outlook, I would have ended the album on that song. I think it's interesting that he didn't, that it's not the last song. It doesn't kind of end the chapter. I personally would have. I think if that's what kind of the goal was of the album, that's what I would have ended it on.
Yeah.
Interesting. I go ahead, Nish.
No, I say I totally agree. I think it's stuck in there at like eight or nine.
Yeah. 6 or 7.
And I definitely think it was an interesting placement for it. Judah, since you're a drummer, why don't we start off with you? The song, and this is a point I want to make, the song starts out with a pretty significant drum intro. It's kind of got this like 4/4 beat to go. It takes you like one or two measures before the rest of the music comes in. What are your thoughts on Bruce Springsteen starting off songs like that? The reason I ask is because I believe he does this 4 times in this album on The Rising. Songs that start off with like a very classic kind of 4/4 type beat. I'm not talking just like a fill into the song. In his prior kind of basically since from Greetings up until Born in the USA, he basically does that one time and it's on Cadillac Ranch. So what are your thoughts on Bruce? Does it tell you anything about the song that's coming up when Bruce starts with a kind of very classic 4/4 drum beat, and why does he start doing that later on?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, well, for one, like the way he uses Max is very different than how his original drummer, or I guess the first drummer on E Street, in Greetings and Wild the Innocent, plays a lot of his songs. Like, Max is really used for kind of like, I mean, he says, like, Max, who, you know, brings the power night after night after night after night, and he really uses that kind of in a lot of Max's songs. He's just like kind of like a steady, like a rock. Max is just like there bringing the power, laying down this like tight but powerful beat. What I think is most interesting, though, is like, I always thought that given the timing, like it actually made a lot of sense for the time. Max is playing kind of a 2000s-y kind of beat where it's like, it's open hi-hat. It's got like it's kind of dirty, but it's a simple like boom, bop, boom, boom, bop, boom, bop, boom, boom, bop. So I always really liked the drum intro. And I just thought it was great for like, it's always fun to see guys who have like a 40 or 50 year music career playing something that is contemporary with the time. I mean, now it's whatever, it's, you know, almost 20 years old, but at the time, like that was cutting edge. Like, that was what people were playing. So right. I like the opening, and I especially like I hope I'm not fucking this up. Like, I'm pretty sure there's a harmonica in there in that. Cause I'm pretty sure there's a harmonica later in the solo. There's definitely a solo that has harmonica and guitar. I'm like really kind of sure, but I don't really know. You might know better than I do.
Well, I want to get back real quick to your point though about kind of playing that contemporary style. And I totally agree, because I think what's interesting about when you start off a song like that is it tells you exactly where this song is going. It tells you exactly what genre it's in. Whereas a lot of his earlier stuff, you don't really know where the song is going until sometimes like halfway through the song. Right? I mean, think about some of those early songs. I mean, they start off with organs and pianos, and by the end of the song, they're rocking and rolling, and you don't know that until halfway through. This song really comes out right out of the bat and says, this is what we're playing. This is a rock song. Like you said, it's a contemporary 2000s rock song. It's going to be upbeat. It's going to get you going, get you dancing, get you moving, which I think is actually at that, you know, unique for him. He's kind of starts doing that later on in his career, which I find interesting. So I definitely agree with you on that.
It signifies kind of that transformation that we see from Bruce, and we kind of see, you know, nowadays, of that change from really straight up kind of rock and roll grooving, you know, dancing bar band type of feel to strictly kind of what I would say Americana, you know, sound, even leading into kind of country. It's like a country pop Americana sound that really you can kind of see Bruce for the last 20 years, I would say, really starting in the Rising. And this song really exemplifies that kind of sound. You know, it's that kind of twanging guitar reminds you of, and even the lyrics, right, out in the desert, just doing my time. Like, it reminds you of kind of an outlaw in the West. And,
oh, 100%.
Stark difference, even lyrically, from all of his earlier stuff.
Well, also, what he does in this one that's kind of a bit of a transition is Bruce is, like, really about to peak in his use of his fake Western country accent, which, as we all know, is one of our favorite aspects of, you know, 21st century Bruce Springsteen, which is Bruce does not actually speak with a country or Western accent, and yet in, you know, 90% of the songs he's written since 2002, he does. It's a miracle for some strange reason. But like you see him doing it occasionally in like the Rising, the River, and like a little bit, you know, in certain of his solo album stuff, like Ghost of Tom Jody does a little bit of that. But the Rising, suddenly you have this song. It's like, well, I'm out in the desert, and he just got this twang. I've been out in the desert.
Let's take the gun.
you further on up the road.
Hit the road. And it's like, it's great because that's just not how anybody from New Jersey speaks. And so right. I kind of love that.
Yeah, D, I think you hit it perfectly on the head when you said that it's really this kind of, he's always done the Americana thing and he's always used that as like a stepping point for the kind of the rest of his style. But starting with The Rising until his most recent album, we get a significant amount of like Americana mixed with rock. And he does this great kind of combination of like taking classic Americana style lyrics and style music and putting it with his sound and his rock and roll sound. And I really do think this album and this song is kind of a, that's when we start to hear it the most. And I really think you can really use The Rising as like a, well there, I mean, it literally is Bruce pre-2000 and Bruce post-2000, and The Rising gives you that stark contrast. And they're, you know, different musicians, but great each unto themselves.
Great on top of each other of them.
Great into each other.
That's like John Mulaney's bit about in church when he's like peace unto you also. And he's like, it's just a little bit off. Like, there's something just a little bit not right about it. Oh, and for you also should have some.
I have a question, not John Mulaney oriented. So okay, first, does Bruce sound old here? With this transition to 2000, do you think that Bruce sounds different?
Dove, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Again, kind of what, you know, based off what we've been kind of talking about, this really signifies a change. We kind of see a change from this kind of cool talking cat from Jersey, where he could be from Jersey, but it could also be from a lot of different other places, and you kind of don't know what he's up to like, pretty much what sounds like kind of an old, I imagine this guy living somewhere in the Rust Belt, somewhere in the recently Biden won state, shout out Blue Wave. But, I think he does sound old. He doesn't sound as old as he does now. Definitely now it's kind of sad to a little bit see him, you know, realizing he is 70 years old, and even though he can still rock out, now he is a man of...
But I think... One thing to counter there, though, and I tend to agree that, like, it feels like an older Bruce, but let's think about it. I mean,
he's 50.
He's 50, right? But either way, like, well, yeah, first off, he's 50, and his last album came out when he was 35. Like, that is a big life difference.
Right.
So aside from the fact that it makes sense that he sounds older and is writing about older things, which I think is something you definitely see with his original kind of E Street Band discography that ends with Born in the USA. Like, in Born in the USA, he doesn't sound anything like the guy from Asbury Park. Like, right, he sounds completely different there. And frankly, in The River, like, he doesn't really either. He doesn't sound like he's in, you know, Wild the Innocent, and he's, you know, living on the Lower East Side, you know, running around like a wild man. And Nebraska, he certainly doesn't sound like that. He sounds like someone completely different. And frankly, Nebraska is probably like the original Bruce with his fake country or Western accent, but we won't go there. I guess my point is, as much as growing up, I think I always felt, and maybe it was like an ageist kind of like feeling shitty for myself that I wasn't around when Bruce was putting out what I think was his best material in the 70s and 80s. I do think, like, looking back now, I recognize that every one of his albums, or for the most part, many of his albums, you know, they naturally are going to sound different, and it's not necessarily worse.
There's
definitely a progression, exactly. And he sounds older here, but then if you listen to Western Stars, he sounds way older there, right? Like, there's this natural age progression that there's no way, I mean, you know, it's Father Time. He's undefeated, right? So,
yeah. That's a good point. I want to talk about our favorite parts of the song real quick. I have a few. First of all, the song really never gives up. It never has a break. And with a lot of Bruce's songs, you expect at the three-quarter point, and there's even a spot at the three-quarter point before they go into, maybe it's either the last verse or the last chorus, where you could totally see structurally them break it down and have, which we'll see kind of later on, they do a little more of. And this never does that. This song is basically on a slow trajectory upwards the entire time, really giving you this like never letting up feel And they do it so well with the arrangement, which is my next point, which is that the arrangement is, I mean, it's super guitar heavy, yes, but there's these really like light mandolin and piano and organ parts that are super far in the back. And I'm wondering, Judith, maybe you thought that was a harmonica. I didn't hear harmonica. Maybe it was. Maybe it was organ that you were hearing. But they keep it super far back. And it's one of these things where, like, it makes the song still sound super rocky with a very heavy guitar sound. But it adds these really interesting notes to the background that I find add this, like, both a brightness and a hauntingness, which is really my theme for this entire episode, is how do you contrast brightness with hauntingness, because that's what this whole song is. It is a song that is haunting by nature, right? It's scary, the lyrics are dark, and yet the theme of the song is overcoming hope. And it's bright and it's hope. Yeah. So I really want to discuss with all three of the ones that we're going to talk about how they get both those ideas at the same time, because they're kind of opposites. This hauntingness with the brightness, and I think that the mandolin, the organ, the piano do a great job of adding both this kind of like haunting quality, because they're so far deep in the back, but they're hitting a lot of really bright and high pitched notes that also add that nice brightness. The last thing that I want to say about the song that I really love is it's super subtle. It's this bass thing that happens on the last chorus. So the last chorus is a double chorus, and in the last half of that double chorus, the bass plays just like three unique notes, where the whole time the bass has been playing just like super classic, like basically playing roots and fifths. And right in the end, the bass plays these thirds under the chorus. And, you know, it's hard to describe without you listening to it, but they add this really interesting depth and this little bit of tension just at the end that I think really add to that theme of like, if you're at this up, like hopeful, bright spot, and it's, you're gonna get to the end, and then all of a sudden the bass kind of like reminds you there's like some tension down in there, and it's hard to explain, but listen back to it, you'll hear closely that the bass just has like three different notes, like a walk down of thirds, that are super interesting and add a great depth to it. So
yeah, well, it's kind of like the crest of the song, you know, like it's not exactly like, right, like in a traditional song. Well, I guess I don't know if this is necessarily for a traditional song. Like if you thought about a novel, right, like the climax would be, you know, before the whatever denouement and then the
right
last one in from my seventh grade English teacher. But for this song, like the crest of that song where you're kind of at that point of like, which way is this going to go, is really that end. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Dove, what would you say is your favorite aspect or part of the song?
Lyrically, I always loved, for me, even though it was a classic, you know, I take the good times as they go, I'll meet you further on up the road. For me, I loved the, I've got a fever burning in my soul. Mm-hmm. I also thought that was kind of like, like that was right, that crest in the song for me was that chain, or they keep on going back to, you know, and I'll meet you further up the road, and I've got this fever burning in my soul, and that's kind of where it changes and then heads into kind of overdrive.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Kind of my favorite part.
That is the spot where it does head, like you said, into
the
overdrive. That's the part where it exponentially grows, and that's also because that line comes on the like unique chord of the song where they play like I'll talk about it later, but like they play like a major 5-7 chord in a minor key, and so it's this like very different sound, and so that's the line that comes on that. So I definitely agree. Judah, do you have a favorite part of the song?
I think the first guitar strum. I think that is just that always. I hear that, I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
All right.
Very memorable.
Bender Rhodes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very memorable, and also very, like, in my opinion, he's not such a Bruce-y. Remember, Bruce, you know, other than a little bit in, like, the early days and some darkness, we don't get
he's
such.
He's a piano guy.
Yeah, we don't get so much, like, distorted guitar, and we do get that a lot here. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the things I was thinking, was that it reminds me of, like, Adam Raise to Cane and some of those, like, classic.
Even the
solo is such a Bruce solo. It's, like, just these, like, simple bends. Yeah, it's dirty with these bends, and he's basically just playing the melody, but it does it in such a nice way. So, well, I love the song. I think it's a great starting off point for two covers that are super interesting in that we have Johnny Cash's version coming up next. Johnny Cash releases his version in the 2006 posthumous album, America 5, 100 Highways. It was recorded prior to his death in 2003 and released on this album. This album went gold and was Johnny Cash's first number one album in 37 years. So, I mean, I see a connection here between this song being put on The Rising, a song that wins Bruce a Grammy, and this album by Johnny Cash, which is a gold album and his first number one in 37 years. Coincidence? I think not. This is an incredible song by Johnny Cash. And Johnny Cash has been known to cover Bruce songs. He does Johnny 99. He does I'm on Fire. He does some, and he's a great cover artist himself. He's done some amazing things. When I think about this song, to me, you know, his voice really captures this song, obviously. And again, it captures those qualities of like haunting and bright at the same time. What I like about Johnny Cash's voice here is that he doesn't actually get too caricaturistically. He's not he's not too much of a Johnny Cash caricature in this, where he's like got the really deep gritty. He has like a much more like open voice here. Obviously, he's got the low tone and the some of the grit, but it's a much more open voice for him that I really appreciate here. And yeah, I'd love to hear your initial thoughts on this version.
Well, so I think the thing that I come away from this song from Johnny Cash feeling is predominantly that I think his prospects of hope are far lower than whoever the protagonist in Bruce's song is. And I think that's probably something I've said on other episodes of this podcast where, like, you know, like the way Johnny Cash sings this song, oh man, I mean, this guy doesn't seem like he stands much of a chance at all. So that's kind of like one aspect that I would think about. I'm trying to think. I mean, the other thing that I really like in this one is Johnny's version, I think, really builds super nicely. Like it starts so simply, and by the final chorus, I feel like he's added in like four or five other instruments. He must add an instrument or two every chorus, and I love that.
Yeah, you're completely right. And I actually went through it and tried to make a list. It starts off with these double guitars and him, then the drums and the bass enter, then the piano enters at that first chorus and is playing those really low notes.
Like the piano, I think, yeah. So those low notes are, to me, what make the song.
Well, they're the lowest notes humanly possible to create.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what I meant.
I want to get back to the piano, but hold on one sec. So he does piano in the first chorus. Then to end the first chorus, he gets like an electric piano or like a synth in there, and it brightens it up again. And then he has the piano playing high notes with a string. And then an organ enters just to play what I think might just be one riff.
It's one riff. It's one lick.
And then that's it. So by the end of the song, he's added a full arrangement to a song that starts off very stark and very closed off.
And I love that. I think the organ in there, what I was saying about the piano is like that really kind of brings such like a rich depth to this song that I love. Dove, what do you think?
I actually kind of feel the opposite than you guys. For me, the original Bruce, Prison Off the Road, Off the Rising, and way more than that, the live version, is really this complex kind of medley of instruments. This is really bare bones. In my mind, actually, the finger picking of the intro here is way more iconic than either of the other two versions. For me, as soon as I hear that, I completely, first of all, I know it's Johnny Cash, I know it's Off the Road.
Yep.
Where the road is dark.
It's one of those reasons why we always thought that Bruce had covered Johnny because it sounds like such a Johnny Cash song.
It totally does.
I always thought this was one of those folk songs and nobody really knows who wrote it.
Right.
Everybody has a version. And so that's why I really thought, and for me, when I thought about the song, it was the Johnny Cash version, because he is kind of that old, you know, folky kind of sound.
We've had arguments about this. We've had arguments about this. Like, Johnny Cash wrote the song in 1971. Bruce covered it 25 years later. It's like, that's not true.
Yeah.
We also all thought at one point that this was like Farther Up on the Road or whatever the fuck that song is.
Absolutely.
That it was one of these like ancient folk songs that nobody knew where it came from, which is just totally not true.
Kind of like, you know, like Baby I'm Gonna Leave You that Zeppelin does. I was pumped for those two ones together, even though we realized now those were both written by people and ripped off by those people. So for me, this really is, you know, this is the version. It's kind of one of those things that even though it's sad and it's haunting, kind of one of those songs that can put you to sleep because it's just so smooth and I can just listen to his voice forever. Half the time it just sounds like he's talking to you and he's not even singing. For me, this is the version. This is definitely my favorite version.
Interesting.
Yeah, the intro, I will agree with you. The intro is fantastic.
It's iconic.
I definitely think it's a little bit more interesting than the Bruce version. It's so iconic with those dueling guitars that play off each other so nicely and create an entirely different melody. I mean, remember, a lot of people who cover songs, it's very hard to write the same song with slightly different melodies, especially in an intro. And Johnny Cash does it so well. I mean, the chords are basically the same. They're like pitched down or whatever, but the chords are the same. Melody's basically the same, but a totally different sound. Really one of the more different sounding pieces we've looked at on the show, I think.
Can we talk about, like, go ahead.
He doesn't have the line of, so let's take the good times as they go and let me eat food on the road. He's totally skipped that whole kind of right high point crescendo, maybe because he really can't even go that high at this point in his life, and he just kind of has to keep it mainstream.
It's also not a very Johnny Cash line. Yeah. I mean, like we said, this is a much more haunting song. With only slight notes of brightness compared to Bruce, which is kind of cutting that 50-50 thing where it's like you're never really sure if it's more haunting
Bruce is a hopeful kind of guy. One thing I'd like to point out, am I right about this? I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. Johnny says, as the bullet's cold, the gun is cocked as the bullet's cold, but I think the line is and the bullet's cold.
Someone needs to.
I'm just a bit of a stickler for these lines. I don't know, and I'm gonna have another one later on. I don't know if we're about to transition to the Dublin song, but I'm gonna have another one of those. So, little spoiler for those of you.
Yeah. Well, I want to hop on the music theory train real quick, if you'll oblige.
Choo-choo.
which is that. Okay, so basically, like I was saying before, there's that point in the song for both of these versions where they hit that, like Dove was saying, with what was the line you mentioned, Dove?
Got the fever burning in my soul.
Right, I got the fever burning in my soul, right? And that's that part that hits that interesting chord. So I just want to really quickly mention, that chord is, and someone who knows more about music theory is going to say that I'm wrong here, but long story short, they're in a minor key, okay? So they're in a minor key, and that chord is a major 5-7 chord. What it's used as is it does exactly what I think the theme of this song is. It adds this dissonance naturally, right? You're going out of the key center to a major sound. So you're getting the brightness of the major, but it's also dissonant. It has the seventh in it. And so it kind of does both of those at the same time. What I think is very interesting here is that Bruce's song, like we said, is a little bit more hopeful the whole time. And so he uses this chord as like a dissonance creator. When this chord gets there, like we said in that climax, it's really this important, powerful, tension-creating chord. When Johnny uses the exact same chord, he does it slightly differently. And the way he does it is basically, Bruce Springsteen, when he goes from that chord, he goes from the one chord, right? So the minor one chord into this dissonant major 5-7 chord, and it creates this brightness, but really mostly tension. When Johnny does it, Johnny Cash is coming not off of the one chord, but he's coming off of the major 3 chord. this major three chord is already creating some brightness. And so when the new major 5-7 chord comes in, rather than it being super dissonant, it just extends the brightness. And I think that's really the point I wanted to make, is that it's very interesting how two composers can use the same chord basically, but based off of the context, make it give you a totally different emotion. So Bruce's really uses it to create tension. And I think Johnny really uses it to create this sense of brightness in an otherwise relatively haunting song.
Further on up the road, further on up the road, further on up the road, further on up the road. One sunny morning, we'll rise, I know, and I'll meet you further on.
Up the road. So that's just a little bit of a little bit in the music theory corner for anyone who cares. And it's basically turning a major 5-7 chord into what we call a Picardy third. If you want to look up the Picardy third, you can. We can do it. You can do it on your own time, though. So
that was going to be the next thing I was going to do, was talk about the Picardy third, but I'm glad that you covered it.
Are you sure you don't want to give everyone a synopsis of what the Picardy third is?
No, I was going to do it in terms of drums, but it's fine.
Okay. All right.
It's so unique. But of all the episodes that you guys have done, usually the way you see the progression of the song is kind of an artist will do a song, and then kind of a newer band will cover it and kind of take a new look on an older song, kind of paying, you know, homage to an older artist. And here it's completely opposite. Here, guy Johnny Cash, who even though Bruce Springsteen is, you know, we love him so much, and he's kind of in our mind, you know, one of the godfathers of rock and roll. Johnny Cash is kind of as influential and important to you know, music, contemporary music, as you can find. And so interesting for all people, for him to kind of play homage to Bruce, when it really should be the other way around.
Totally. It's totally paying a huge amount of respect to a great songwriter by having Johnny Cash cover not only this song, but he's covered many of Bruce's songs, and it's totally paying respect. That's why I think if we do get to doing the Nine Inch Nails song, we'll see that again. I mean, having Johnny Cash cover your song when you're Nine Inch Nails must feel like, yeah, oh my God, what is going on? I mean, totally a really great sign of respect. So let's move on to our last version of this song. This is the Bruce Springsteen live in Dublin with the Seeger Sessions Band. I know he took out Seeger from the album because they didn't want to be connected with Seeger, yada, yada, yada. They wanted to be on their own, whatever. So this is it's recorded in 2006. I think the album comes out in 2007. Which is really only a few months after Johnny Cash's version, right? Johnny Cash's version comes out in like July of 2006, and Bruce is playing it live in Dublin in like November of 2006. So whether they're related to one another, I'm not to say. But I think it's very interesting. I mean, this is one of the only times we're seeing Bruce, aside from his solo career, having a band that's not the E Street Band. The only person in this band of E Street is Patty. There's no one else.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, what's funny is, like, in his later incarnations of the E Street Band, there are actually a bunch of parts of the Seeger Sessions Band. What's cool about watching the Sessions Band is that if you've seen Bruce live in the last, you know, 10 years, you've seen that there are a lot of people from this band that end up in Bruce's live shows and parts of, for all intents and purposes, E Street Band. For example, Charlie Giordano, who is a big part of this, of the Sessions Band, becomes an integral part of the E Street Band and basically takes over for Danny Federici when Danny Federici dies. Sister Susie Tyrell plays violin, I think, throughout the entire Working on a Dream live tour. I think he uses like one of the vocalists, I forget the guy's name, but he's amazing. He's this like big, like really ripped guy, and Bruce uses him. And I think there are a bunch of parts of the Miami horns that are in this Sessions Band. So that's a long way of saying I have no idea, but I wonder if the success of the Sessions Band brings these people into the fold and into E Street, Which is great because these are some of my favorite parts of the E Street Band. I mean, Sister Susie Tyrell with her electric violin, especially in this song, it's unbeatable. I mean, that violin duet, by the way, that back and forth solo of the dueling violins is like on another planet for me.
100%. And we'll get to that in a minute. I want to hear your take, though. It seems like our youngest brother is dealing with some technical difficulties, and we'll be back on with us in a minute. So while we have you here, Judah, alone, why don't you tell us a little bit about, some of your favorite parts of kind of the beginning of the song, how the song is different from the original. It's Bruce Springsteen redoing his song. Sorry, I guess for the listeners, we should explain. It's Bruce Springsteen redoing his song in an entirely different manner to the point where you would have no clue that they're the same song. They're completely and utterly different.
For it to be an artist doing it to himself is very unique. I mean, we've talked about I think we talked about on that Allman Brothers one podcast we did about the version of...
In Laid Back, Greg Allman's version of Midnight Rider.
Yeah, exactly. How it's like completely different, but either way, I guess my point
but this one is so much more different than Greg Allman's solo version. This is really almost, I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's almost weird to say that this epitomizes a cover, because it's like, well, it's almost the opposite, right? It's like, it's not really a cover, just a guy doing his song differently, but that really is the epitome of a cover. It's saying like, I can take this song I already wrote and completely redo it and change it in a way that makes it sound super different, but that's a cover. That's him covering himself.
Yeah, for sure. It's totally a cover, I think. And I think it's a great type of cover. I think it's my favorite version. I don't want to step on what we're doing later, but it's my favorite version of this song. I adore the arrangement. I adore the I don't know nearly enough about Irish music, but I know that this is like a very kind of well done classic Irish type of song. And I think it's we got Dove coming back in here.
Yeah, he's getting back
connecting
on
audio. Either way, my point is I think it's fantastic. I love, by the way, I think my favorite part is the penny whistle.
Yeah. Okay. We all looked up what it was.
Yeah. Everybody
thought it was a flute or a clarinet, and we looked up that it's called a penny whistle. You didn't know that?
No, I had no idea. I looked it up. I'm not going to pretend to take credit for knowing what a fucking penny whistle is, but. I've listened to whoever plays the penny whistle on this album. Like, I've listened to it, I don't know, 150 times, and I've always just thought it was the coolest thing and had never really heard many other songs using something like that.
I'm Art
like, oh,
Baron.
Wow, this is Art Baron. I was like, wow, this is a guy just doing an amazing job of the recorder. I mean, yeah. Who knew that in third grade when we were learning the recorder, one day we could end up like this guy. I mean, this is incredible. Whoever teaches the recorder at elementary school should really like put this on, be like, this is what you can be one day. Obviously not actually a recorder, but either way, love it.
I think what you said about it being like a classic Irish song is super true. And again, I also don't know nearly enough about like the structure of Irish songs, but I think it does follow a much more classically like folk song structured like format, where what's different here is we start off with a chorus, right? We don't go straight into a verse. We start off with a chorus, and we have a lot of these like chorus, verse, or I guess like chorus, then we go like verse, chorus, break, verse, chorus, break. We get a lot of these like instrumental melodic breaks, which I do think is much more structured like a folk song would be. You definitely get the kind of like folky aspect of this song. Dee, since you're joining us after reconnecting your computer, what are your initial thoughts on this version?
For me, it's just the different voices here really is kind of the stark difference. But in the original version, it's really just kind of Bruce leading in. In the Johnny Cash version, it's all about Johnny. Here, it doesn't even start with Bruce's voice.
Yeah.
And Then it has who is the second or third voice verse has that amazing like bluesy sound. I have no clue this guy is from the Sessions band.
It's so I'm pretty sure it is Mark Anthony Thompson. I could be wrong.
That does a lot for me, Micha.
I think it's Mark Anthony Thompson. He's in the Sessions band. But you're right, D. I think that the harmonies and the vocals here.
That's like the MVP of this version. That verse is amazing.
I mean, how many songs, how many Bruce Springsteen songs?
I don't know
songs?
About that. What about, what's her name? What about, I don't know the woman who sings at the beginning of this, but
it's,
high pitch.
Hold on. I got her name somewhere.
She is amazing.
She's amazing. Yeah.
Such a great voice.
I believe it is Cindy Mazzelli or Mazzell.
Where the road is dark and the seed is sowed, where the gun is cocked and the bullet's cold, the miles are marked in blood and gold. I'll meet you further on up the road. Further up the road, further up the road. I'll meet you further on up the road.
She's incredible. Amazing. Vocals and the harmony here are, I think, one of the high points of this song.
And I've actually seen another version. Another version of this version, I would say, done by Mumford & Sons. And they copy kind of the Dublin, you know, make sense them coming from whatever country they come from.
You're going to have to send that to me. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
Mumford & Sons, I'm pretty sure they're from Pittsburgh. They just put on those silly accents.
Yeah. could be.
It's another case of guys putting on accents just to sound like they're from a different place in a song.
Well. This song, though, you know, each version kind of has a picture in your mind of where you are while listening to the song. And for me, for the Johnny Cash one, it was always that picture in the music video of her, him in that like chair, kind of just like him in his chair talking to you. And this one, I literally picture being in like Ireland, in Scotland or somewhere with this, you know, the green grass, kind of a very brave, hearty kind of feeling to it, out in nature. Kind of vibes. This is the one for Bruce fans. I would say this is definitely the one that everybody kind of talks about. I feel like sometimes even the original version is overlooked. I mean, you think of Further Up the Road by Bruce Springsteen, you instantly go to this one and not even the original.
Well, I definitely think it's a version that if you haven't heard it as a Bruce fan, you need to hear. I want to really quickly talk about, a minute and 26 seconds into the song, you have maybe one of the greatest, dropping the needles of all time. I mean, oh my God, you're listening to this song, and for the first minute, you can totally be thinking that this is just going to be like a simple, quiet kind of folk song. Like, it's not that crazy. It starts off with like a nice little melody and some nice vocalists, and that's it. Not too much music going on. And then a minute 26 seconds in, you get that first musical break. Do 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 do. Where everything comes in.
Everything's cool. Meet you further on up the road.
I think the way that they keep the horn section to be like super delicate and not too dense. Or I mean, so many times we hear horns that are just like blaringly loud and just doing these like long droning notes, which is so unnecessary. These horns are perfect. They wait for the violins to kind of stop, and then they play those little fills that dip, da da da, a little right. I mean, that's great. That's James Brown style horns. That's what you need.
They kind of serve as like an echo, kind of at the end of the like bang bang, like
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So battling fiddles. As a solo, what are our thoughts on battling fiddles?
Definitely not.
Well, I'm in every single song now. I can't even think of a song that I don't want them in. No, it's amazing. I love it. Sister Susie Tyrell is perhaps like one of my favorite parts of a live Bruce show, and she's in it. We've gotten from our dad a tremendous love and appreciation for rock electric violin. I mean, like, is there anything Abba loves more than electric violin in a rock song? And I have to say, there are few greater joys for me as well, and I just love it.
definitely a top two fiddle player in my mind, outside of the only other one I know, which is Charlie Daniels.
Right. Well, so it's Susie exactly. Tyrell.
Also the devil.
Yeah. It's Susie Tyrell battling off with Sam Barfield, I believe. And what I really like about it is what makes it interesting is, you know, guitar solos always, no matter how cool they are, sound structurally very similar. I mean, they just the way that guitarists learn to play is, you know, they take breaks at certain points, and they just the way they create licks is very common. Yeah, obviously they're, you know, jazz musicians and weird, you know, crazy shredders who will play differently. But for the most part, a rock's guitar solo has similar setup, similar structure. I think these fiddles, what makes it so unique is they don't play that same way. They're just the way that the musicians play is differently. And so they kind of take breaks at different points, and they make sometimes like longer passages, sometimes very short passages. And what I really like is that by having the fiddles battle each other, there's really never a point where you're not hearing the fiddle playing. And yet you still get this sense of like taking pauses and breaks. It's something that we talk about in music, right? Is that like a good solo is not one that just continues playing the whole time. You need to have a break. You need to have a pause to create that kind of emotional connection. And with the battling fiddles, you basically don't actually ever have a pause or a break. But since you know that the two different fiddles are like two different musicians, you kind of get that sense of like pause from one, a new fiddle starts, pause from that one, and the next one begins again. So I like the idea of like the battle there. So should we talk about the ending with the all of the different musicians singing kind of one by one?
Yeah.
We have that.
Do you consider that a stop time? I was thinking that felt like a stop time, and I kind of loved it.
I don't think it would technically be called a stop time because there is like something happening. I don't know what you would call it. Other than maybe like a breakdown of sort. But I mean, you basically have like multiple musicians singing, break for instrumental, then Bruce gets in there, then the whole choir gets in there. I mean, this is like arranged and so cleverly. I mean, and then you have that final, again, like an amazing drop of the needle where we get back into that really nice big sound again.
To me, like, this is just such a unique song and I adore it. It's my favorite version.
There you go. I think that brings us perfectly into our set of questions. The first question is, who won the song? I'll let our youngest take it away. Who won the song for you, Dove?
Who won the song? So I would say that the live version in Dublin won the song, even though it's not my favorite version of the song, mostly because it does the most with what it's given and creates the most, meaning it's given this kind of Americana rock ballad foundation in a normal version. In the album version, like we said, where we kind of see it's a transition for Bruce. And then they take this kind of change of pace Bruce song and they take it totally another way and bring it back to, I would say, it's even though it is folky and like we said, Scottish and Irish influence, it does kind of still remind you more of like, oh, this reminds us more of Bruce. This is how he would do things. At least to me, it does.
It's a good blend. It's a great blend the rock version, the stripped down Johnny Cash version.
And it does, in my mind, you know, again, musically, it gives the most, like you said, the battling fiddles, the intro, and then even, you know, in terms of vocals, there's the most there. So I think they definitely expanded on what they were given in the first place, better than the Johnny Cash version, which is really more stripped down, which is more, if you're a Johnny Cash guy, you're going to love this. Mm-hmm. So I think that the live version definitely, you know, won.
Awesome. All right, Judah, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bruce wins the song for the simple idea that he has two versions and Johnny has one. I mean, simple math would indicate that that's a win, right? I mean, how else can you explain it? So I think that's it. I think Bruce won it.
All right, that's an interesting answer. I will agree with Dove. I think that the live in Dublin version wins it for me. For me, it's a different reason, though. I actually think that it's the most uplifting of all of the songs. I mean, like I said, the others are kind of really trying to balance the haunting and the uplifting. And this one is not haunting to me. I mean, it's got like the hauntingness of like all Irish Gaelic songs.
Yeah, this is an upbeat, exciting song. This is an exciting song.
Right, and all Irish Gaelic songs have that, like just the sound of it always kind of is like a little bit of a dirgy sound. But this is totally uplifting. All of the drops are super uplifting. You feel like just unbelievably happy at the end. It is so bright. It's and I really think that is the theme of the song. I mean, what you know, the hauntingness is a nice touch, but the theme of the song is upliftment. It's about being hopeful. And I really think that, that Live in Dublin does it.
Upliftment.
I knew you were
gonna
say
when
that.
You think about it, is the key to this song. I'm just joking around.
If you're stranded in a desert island, Judah, which song are you going to take?
I'm definitely taking the Dublin version. I take it for everything. It is the most complete and perfect version of this song. Dove, what do you think?
It appears Dove is having some further technical difficulties. I'll tell you, for the desert island
question. Mika just texted, just so everybody knows, Mika just texted our group chat, where'd you go? Because Dove is just not in his chair anymore.
Anyway.
In either case. Oh, that's Dove. That is Dove.
Anyway, for the desert island question, I'm going to take the Johnny Cash version.
Mostly
because if I'm on a desert island, I'm presuming that I'm dying. And if I'm going to, I'm going to die, I would
you
like
to die listening to Johnny Cash.
I mean, he's going to sing me to sleep and just put me into a place where I feel okay dying, basically. So I mean, Johnny Cash can sing this to me and I'd be like, yep, I'll accept death at that point. So if it's me on the desert island, I'll let Johnny take it away.
You want to be listening to someone who's going to make you accept your fate.
Right, exactly. D, how's your connection?
Seems sounds great, Jim.
My final question is, if you had to choose another Bruce song that Johnny Cash should cover,
recognizing
that he already has covered several. Like I said, I think he did Johnny 99. He does.
I guess presumably we shouldn't answer those then, right?
Yeah. What do you think would be a song that you would like him to cover? I can start with one. I have a few. I'll start with one. I mean, I think Hello Sunshine from the newest album, from the second newest album. Hello Sunshine it's basically a Cash song, I feel like. And that whole album is very, like we said, right when it came out, had a lot of Johnny Cash vibes to it. But I think Hello Sunshine is like perfect for Johnny Cash. It's got just such a great feel and like a great stripped down sense to it. And the vocals are so important there that I think Johnny would really, do it really well. Dove, are you with us?
And we're back.
And we're back.
And we're back.
So for my by the way, I overheard your, as my Wi-Fi was going in and out, I overheard your desert island ideas, and you guys were spot on for sure. I'm going to take my final breaths on this desert island, listening to Johnny Cash, presumably take his last breath.
You guys are just not nearly as hopeful for your desert island like survivor skill set as I am. I'm like gonna thrive there and turn into like.
I'm not envisioning like a Tom Hanks Castaway thing. I'm kind of envisioning more of like.
Your version is Lost, and
Lost, yeah.
You're I'm Lost, but like it's death. One of the people. You're talking about one of the people who dies really early in Lost that like you never really meet or care about.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, but so yeah, the song I'd like to see Johnny Cash, I'd like to see him cover it, although probably won't happen. Yes. I wish he had covered it.
Just hit him when he's down, Dove.
Yeah. Either The Ghost of Tom Joad, because I think that really he could kind of give a little more roughness to the kind of the quiet original version. Mm-hmm. He could bring some more roughness to that. Or I like to see him take Dancing in the Dark and turn it into a folk song.
Interesting.
Wow,
interesting.
I could see that.
I was thinking The River would be a great Johnny Cash song.
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. I was also thinking, I think on the similar lines of maybe D, it's a little different, was Land of Hope and Dreams. I really think Johnny Cash could take that and make it really like intense and... you know, in a land of hope and dreams. Like, I don't know. I
that's
really
a great
feel like
version. I would like to see Mika cover that version as Johnny Cash.
As Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Well, the point is that you can't have Johnny Cash doing any song where Bruce speaks too quickly because Johnny can't do that.
He can't handle that. Yeah,
he
no. He'll trip up his words.
That wordplay. So those are my ideas. Well, guys, appreciate getting this podcast back going. I know it was a little bit of a break for us. We had a lot of things going on in our own lives and this and that and those and who's. But
it's good to get everybody back together.
It is. This is the first time
to get the band back together.
This is the first time the podcast has done everyone virtual. It's the first time the three of us have been all virtual like this.
I think this is our first international podcast.
This is our first international podcast.
Miles away.
D, thanks so much for tuning in. It's midnight for you, basically. Judah, thanks so much for, you know, being you, putting your work aside for this really important project we have. And
look, anytime I can do a podcast while giving myself insulin injections is a win for me, so I'll take it.
I thought you were also running on the treadmill at one point.
No.
We appreciate you taking your time away from your study of the human body.
Good luck on your exam.
It sounds very science-y.
All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed it. Take a listen to all the stuff we talked about, and hopefully we will be on again soon and not in 2 months. We're trying to get some more episodes out. So, all right.